So properly performed, the Corps de Ballet in Swan Lake seems to move as one, and audiences today still marvel at how together they are. It is often assumed, moreover, that they are so together because each dancer has been trained meticulously to calibrate her movements to those of her neighbor. But this is not really how it works. Ivanov's swans are not an assembly line or human machine, not even a closely integrated community. They are an ensemble created by music. His steps do not so much fit the music as allow a dancer to find the phrase and sustain it in movement, making her way into the sound rather than moving smoothly across its surface.
That's Jennifer Homans reading from her new and justly acclaimed book, Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet, published at the end of 2010 by Random House. And I should say, as a number of observers and critics of the book have pointed out already, in many ways, its subtitle is too modest because it is, for many people, the first English language full history of, it is the history of ballet. And we'll talk about why that is as we talk with Jennifer Homans. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jennifer back to Chicago. You grew up, at least in part, in Hyde Park.
I did indeed. I'm very pleased to be back.
And you then went off first to become a ballet dancer and then a scholar and critic of ballet. So you have both toe shoes and a PhD.
That's right. That's right. I left home when I was 15 and went to a ballet school in North Carolina, the North Carolina School of the Arts. Then I moved to New York, where I was trained at the School of American Ballet, the school set up by George Balanchine. And I danced professionally for several years in Chicago, in part with the Lyric Opera Ballet, run at the time by Maria Tolchief. Then I went to the West Coast and danced in Seattle and in San Francisco briefly before I finally stopped dancing. And then I moved back to New York and ended up getting a PhD in modern European history. And so that's when the two sort of parts of my life came back together. Once I had studied the history, I tried to bring it back together with the dance.
And you do so marvelously. The book is a book that anybody with an interest in either history, dance, art, culture, different cultures, and we'll come to that as well, can read with great reward. It does not require a specific background of being a balletman or a technical wizard or even a particular orientation. And that's something I want to clear up, if we can, right at the beginning. The book has received some controversial attention. We'll come to that later, not about so much about controversy, but about the points that I think you're trying to make about where ballet is today. I think in part because people have conflated the word ballet and the word dance. And my understanding would be that dance is something that has existed from the beginning of humankind. Dance is going on as we speak all around the world, be it in a church hall or out on a savanna or a forest clearing or tonight in a nightclub, and dance will always go on. Ballet is a type of dance or is an aspect of dance, but not all dance is ballet, and ballet is not all dance.
No, that's absolutely right. Ballet is a very, very particular art form that really had its origins in the European courts as an aristocratic social dance, and then developed into a technique and an artistic practice. But it is not, you know, any number of other dance forms. It's a very particular art form, and it thrived in the 20th century and up until the present day. But now there is some reason, I think, to question its future.
In order to discuss its present or question its future, we have to know its past, and that's exactly what you've given us with this book, and it explains why that specificity is so important. It's not a pedantic point. It's what makes ballet fascinating, whether one is just reading about its history or actually going to see it. And when you say it started off with courtly dances, the emphasis is not just on dance, but court. This was, in Louis XIV's mind, as you paint the picture here, Versailles was not just a great big place where everybody went to be outside of Paris. It was a giant 3D stage set, and you had a place as a courtier, one of hundreds or even thousands of people, in what was sort of a 24-hour, year-long ballet.
That's right. I mean, the life at court, either, whether it was in Paris or Versailles or at any number of other chateaus that Louis inhabited, was really a grand spectacle. And court was an etiquette, and the courtiers were very, very aware of the rules and the ways of behaving that were required of them in order to fit into Louis's world. You know, ballet has a lot of hierarchies and rules within it. If you look at the way that dancers organize their bodies, it's almost as if you took the gardens at Versailles and you imprinted it onto the human body, the symmetry, the line, the sense of formality, the way that dancers bow, the way that they bend their knees is not just, you know, a bend of the knees in order to take off for a jump. It's also a sign of humility. It's a way of paying respect to somebody who might be of a higher social order than you. So that, you know, it really was a kind of noble aspiration. It was a way of proving your nobility and of expressing your nobility, a way of elevating yourself. If you could organize your body in these very rational ways that were thought to control the passions, make everything look easy. Aristocrats don't work, and very much a matter of dignity. And that was what life at court was run by, ruled by, and the dancers were very much part of that.
Where does the word ballet come from, and where does the codification start?
The word ballet comes from the Italian, and then was sort of transposed into the French. And this gets you to the, you know, the sort of proper origins of the tradition, which are, you know, both in the French and the Italian courts, and the sort of blending and mixing that happened between them, the cross-fertilization. The reason that I, in the book, really give a lot of emphasis to the court of Louis XIV is because that is where the what was a sort of set of social practices, ballroom dances, the way the etiquette, which is laid out in etiquette manuals and in fencing manuals, which had some crossover with dance, all of that, those kind of social practices, are codified into the five positions that dancers today who study anywhere in the world will learn, the first, second, fourth, and fifth positions. These were codified in the court of Louis XIV.
We'll come back to what those positions are and why they were and why they remain important. But let's talk a little bit more about Louis. And I have to say, we could probably do an entire program on each chapter in the book because each of them is a study of France, of Italy, of Russia, of the Soviet Russia, of America, of the transportation of these arts and the individuals as well to this country. Louis XIV, in addition to being an absolute ruler and having this wild, huge court outside of his capital city, also spent hours of every day practicing gymnastics, fencing, and ballet.
He was a devoted dancer. He studied from the time he was a child, and he performed in spectacles, and he was involved in the making of spectacles. Right up, he danced for about 18 years, and then he retired. People were worried that it was creating sort of fevers in him. The exertion was too much for him. But even after he actually stopped performing, he was still very involved. He would attend rehearsals. And I mean, ballets were not just an entertainment. They were really a matter of state. So it mattered enormously, both as an enjoyment and a pleasure, because pleasure was very important at the court, but also as a form of an expression of his own power.
I'm wondering what, if any, are the equivalents today. In recent history, I guess in our memory, I would think of the May Day parades in Moscow in the Soviet Union or the giant exhibitions in Beijing when 8 billion people would hold up cards that would make Mao's picture or something. Or I imagine in an even more tragic way, North Korea today has some of these things where you are a part of the state and the state is doing a giant dance.
Yeah, no, I think there are parallels there, but it's also important to remember that, you know, at Louis' court there was also a lot of satire and a lot of kind of almost wicked, you know, undercutting of himself. You know, a lot of the work of Molière comes from this period. Absolutely.
And Molière is there both providing material and observing and getting material.
That's right. That's right. In the Bourgeois Gentilhomme, for example, you know, he's both expressing this sort of noble etiquette and making fun of it in a very sharp, witted way. And these are things that were performed at court. So, you know, there was room for a wider range than maybe you had in some of the more totalitarian states where mm-hmm. where the propaganda was more was less flexible.
Now, when we speak of ballet today and in the 20th century, even in the 19th century, a lot of our focus is on the female corps and on the ballerina, and we're going to keep talking about that. But at Louis' court, as with so many things, such as Shakespeare's plays, the gender distribution was very different in terms of entertainment.
That's right. I mean, people forget today because today we, as you said, we think of ballet as the art of the ballerina. But in Louis's time, it wasn't. It was a male-centered art. The men were the ones who had the most difficult roles. They were the virtuosos. The women were either not in the performance because the female roles were danced by men, or when they did begin performing, were certainly second to the men. So it was a very different thing. It really was a dance of princes and kings and noblemen, and it privileged male dancers. It was only later, in the 18th and 19th centuries, that the art form really became feminized.
The art form became feminized, and also it began to connect to the wider public. Even the concept of a word such as public becomes something that matters as we move into the 18th century and into the 19th century. How does ballet move from court to the wider world?
Well, you know, it moves with the history. It take the case of France, which is, I think, the most important one, because dancers across Europe were looking to France as an example and as the high point of ballet, and so a lot of imitation of France was happening. And there, as you say, in the 18th century, as the notion of a public began to develop, as and particularly as you get to the French Revolution, when you know an art form that is fundamentally aristocratic in its identity suddenly becomes a problem. Just as the aristocracy becomes a problem, and the bitter hatred during the French Revolution for everything aristocratic was transferred directly to ballet. So you had, you know, the storming of the Bastille, but you also had the storming of the Opéra, where, you know, there was a sense that this was a place where infested with aristocratic privilege, and it had to be either shut down or taken away or changed. And what happens to the art form is that the male dancer becomes discredited along with the aristocrat that he represents. And dancers start drawing and borrowing from more popular traditions. They start taking from Italian players, from acrobats. This had always been going on, but it happens in a much more exaggerated form. And so the technique becomes more athletic. It becomes more extreme. This is when you get the change from the five positions being a kind of relaxed mode to it being a 180-degree turnout, the technique that we know today. As male dancers sort of push things almost towards the grotesque, and as a kind of commentary an escape from the aristocratic heritage which they had. And that's the moment at which the male dancer in France becomes something that people just don't want to see. And women start to sort of fill the void.
Even though the purpose of the attack was not feminist.
No, that's right. The purpose of the attack was not feminist. It had nothing to do with that. Nobody knew that this would happen. But, you know, in the 1820s and 1830s, what you start to have is this incredibly athletic male technique, which people are kind of uncomfortable with because there's a lot of criticism. You know, why are they doing all those turns? Why are they jumping so high and throwing their legs up? It's a betrayal of the classical traditions. It's not something that we can really relate to anymore. And then you get, you know, in particular, Marie Taglioni, an extraordinary dancer who, in this case, you know, an individual really does make a difference, who comes in and she manages to take a lot of those technical changes and innovations and adopt them to her own body so that she's an extraordinarily strong and technically accomplished dancer. But she adds a kind of aristocratic feeling, elevation, the sense of elevation without being aristocratic. It's a feeling of elevation, of refinement, and of something higher than the acrobatics that were being performed by the men.
And this is somebody who as with almost everybody, it seems, in the story of ballet, comes from a wonderfully mixed background, but is in France, in her case. And we're talking in the early 19th century.
That's right. We're talking in the early 19th century. And she, as you can tell from her name, had Italian roots, but was born in Stockholm and had, you know, like so many dancers, a life on the road. Her parents were both performers, and they especially her father. And so, you know, they lived in many different cities and many different places. But it was always towards France that people gravitated, and including the Taglioni family. And Marie's training was at the Paris Opera.
Let's pause for just a moment and maybe literally, I guess, walk us through the five positions and maybe a little bit about how ballet dancers were trained as these were being developed, and how different, if at all, the training of somebody, say, that you experienced is today.
The five positions are as they were performed, you know, in the 17th century and the early 18th century, were quite different than they are today. They were a much more relaxed position. Dancers did work. They did train on a daily basis. We don't know exactly what they held, but usually either their ballet master's hands or the back of a chair. Sometimes there were ropes from the ceiling that they could hold on to. So that's how they would steady themselves. The technique, the steps were smaller.
And just what are they, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5?
Oh, the steps. Positions. The positions are, you know, the heels together in first position. The second position takes the body. You just separate your legs 1 foot, so to the sides.
And your feet are parallel.
And your feet are turned out.
Or turned out.
Your feet are turned out in all of these positions.
Right.
In this case, about 45 degrees, a little more maybe. And the first position is a kind of home position. Your legs are right under you. You can stand comfortably. The second position is as if you were moving to the side. And it's very geometric. It's not, you know, to the side and a little to the front. It's exactly to the side. The third position brings the feet back together, sort of the heel to the middle part of the other foot. And the fourth position is as if you took a step straight forward. Again, not a little bit to the side, but straight forward. And it sort of maps the directions in clear angles out of the body so that the dancer can travel in those directions. And then fifth position, heel to toe, is really the most, you know, if you dropped a plumb line from the head of from the top of your head straight down, you'd have a single line, a single balance point right from the top all the way down to the bottom of your where your toes are.
And these were and are building blocks, among other things.
These are the grammar of ballet.
The grammar.
I mean, everything starts from here. Everything comes back to this. I remember one of my own teachers telling me, you know, that the first position is the gateway. It's the gateway to everything. And you have to really understand. This is why dancers begin their day now, and they did then, with their feet in these positions. And then, you know, a series of exercises developed out of these positions. In Louis' time, people often practiced the dances themselves. Today, we have the steps are broken down into smaller and smaller pieces so that you can master them in a series that makes rational sense.
And you might do them, and you would do them now, usually in class. And there's also a bar on
today,
the wall.
Yeah, exactly. You would hold on to a bar, although I can't tell you how many dancers practice, you know, in hotel rooms hanging onto the back of a chair just the way they have since time began for dancers. You know, today the class is about an hour and a half long. Back then, we know the classes in the early 19th century were often 2-3 hours long, so similar length, a little bit longer perhaps even at times. They also had shorter classes, so it depends. But the training by the early 19th century was quite similar to the training we have today. For example, we have a series of classes that were written down by the ballet master Vestris. And he was one of these men who was developing the technique after the French Revolution. And the class, if you go through it, I mean, is very, very difficult. And the demands it makes on the dancer are quite similar to the ones that are made today, in some cases even harder. So, you know, there are very strong connections. The tradition has been passed along with great continuity since that point.
You mentioned also an increase in the degree of turnout. And when and why does that happen?
That happens also after the French Revolution, in this period where the men are pushing the technique. The men in particular, pushing the technique and making it more acrobatic and athletic. They're being criticized for this. And eventually, in a way, you know, they fail because they are themselves discredited. But the changes that they made in the technique stay. That's what we have today.
And one of the main transmitters and developers of those changes and advocates becomes then Miss Taglioni.
That's right. That's right.
And people are making dances for her. She is taking over dances and making them for her.
That's right. I mean, the ballet that we have some contact with that she was famous for is La Sylphide, which was created in Paris in 1832. You know, the version that we know today is actually the version that was created a little bit later in Denmark by the ballet master Auguste Bournonville. But you know, you can get some sense of the feeling from this work, and we also know from descriptions of Taglioni's dancing at the time, you know, that it was a very ethereal, sort of fleeting, lost, unrequited love, a sense of escape and flying. She was at one point hooked up to an apparatus that allowed her to sweep across the stage and fly. So these were the sort of, you know, it was a very romantic era production.
We have posters of her. We have written descriptions, silhouettes, drawings. How was she regarded vis-a-vis the rest of society? How was a dancer regarded? And was she similar to or different from an actress or other kinds of public women of that time?
Yeah, it's a really good question. The, you know, dancers, like actresses, as you say, were often from the lower orders of society. They were, you know, thought to be often they were kept by men whose intentions were not always honorable.
That would ever happen today.
Not that it would ever happen today. But there was a sort of association, you know, with dancers and not so much prostitution, but close, you know, sort of a looser kind of morality.
The same way there was a disregard for but an addiction to the life of actors and actresses.
That's
Don't
right.
put your daughter on the stage. And,
right. But know. Also, you know, when she's there, she actually has a lot more freedom than some of her compatriots, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But Marie Taglioni was quite different in this way because she really managed to embody a kind of bourgeois ethic. She was very careful about her reputation, and she did not have this image. And, you know, one of the interesting things about her is that bourgeois women were very, very drawn to her. And she had a kind of following amongst this group that we don't have evidence for really before this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she had a kind of respectability about her. She was a good woman. She worked hard. She was demure. And in point of fact, she was actually divorced. And there were all kinds of things about her life that would not have fit this image.
But she knew how, today we might say, she knew how to control her image.
She knew how to control her image. And she was an international star. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's important to remember that her career comes at a moment when the press is exploding. And, you know, there are ways of communicating her stature and of controlling her image that were really new. So, you know, she had a reputation across Russia. She performed all over Europe. Even the Americans knew about her.
We're speaking with Jennifer Homans, H-O-M-A-N-S. Jennifer writes about dance for The New Republic and other publications. She's based in New York City, and she is the author of Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet, recently published by Random House and already up for a number of awards and other distinctions, and beautifully illustrated as well. We can't share all the photographs and drawings with you on the air, but I can assure you it is worth it for the words, the extensive footnotes, because this is an academic study, but it is not academic in its writing or in its form. And then it, of course, is rewarding to read the narrative portions as well. I'm Andrew Patner. You're listening to Critical Thinking on 98.7 WFMT in Chicago and or over WFMT.com. You can hear this or any of our programs at any time, WFMT.com/Critical Thinking, home to our free podcast. Southeast of France and northeast of France are two countries that if you were to just stop somebody on the street right now, even maybe somebody in line for the New York City Ballet at Lincoln Center, and said, what are the most important countries in the history of dance? Italy and Denmark would not necessarily spring to people's lips today. But in fact, Italy as a set of nations and cities and principalities and dukedoms and so on, and Denmark more in due to a single presence and the support that he had, a single individual, are hugely important and in many ways either forgotten or neglected chapters that you've reinserted now into the history.
Yes, no, that's right. I mean, Italy was, you know, dance was important in Italy really from the Renaissance straight forward into the 19th century. And it's only really in the 19th century that it is in some ways, you know, displaced or lost into opera, which becomes, of course, the great Italian art form. And dance sort of falls into a state of decline. It becomes more spectacle, more sort of brash, less artistic. You know, the interesting thing about Italy is that in the 19th century, they developed tremendous dancers. So the technique, which I'm very interested in because I'm sort of very interested in what happened to, from the point of view of a dancer, to this ballet technique. And it became very developed under the Italians. And in fact, that's what really sort of gives the Russians, the Russian tradition, some of its main impetus is this sort of Italian style that became so athletic, and they could do many pirouettes. They could balance for hours. They, you know, they had point work that was much more developed than anywhere else in Europe. But at the same time, in Italy itself, as the country is unified, ballet lost really its artistic sensibility.
You sort of present Italy as the country that might have been in terms of a leading role.
It should have been because really, I mean, they had everything there. They had the etiquette. They had the princes, the sort of noble tradition. They had spectacle. They had tremendous opera houses that had, you know, a sort of deep presence in the civic life of many Italian cities. And ballet was much loved, especially in the 17th century.
Tell us about Salvatore Vigano.
Vigano.
His father had an even greater southern Italian name, Oronato, I think.
That's right. And he had a sort of short but incredibly important presence in the early 19th century in Milan and at La Scala. He created ballets that you could really say that these were coming from a real Italian source. They were trying to draw on classical traditions, to draw on pantomime, and sort of before Italy was Italy, to create a sort of sense of a national tradition in a way, and separate, deliberately separate from the French tradition, which had also a strong presence in Italy throughout. You know, French dancers at that time were known as the more technically advanced, and they were the lead performers in the Italian opera houses. But Vigano said, "No, wait, let's go back to these other traditions," and he created huge spectacles with you know, literally hundreds of people that tried to integrate dance with, but especially with pantomime, with mime. The idea was, how do you tell a story without words and really just with music and with movement and with a kind of rhythmic pantomime?
Now, as you are talking, not only about this, you did grow up next door to me for part of your life and I next door to you for part of mine, but you are not Italian, but you are speaking with your hands. And here is a culture and a country and a group of peoples who are the most physically expressive. And you have some wonderful quotes sprinkled throughout the book as well. I shouldn't say sprinkled, selected with great care, wonderful quotes from historians, poets, philosophers. And when we get to Italy in the book, you talk about how people who could make their hands as lips.
Right. This
telling of stories through pantomime, commedia dell'arte, all of these things were already in the mix.
Right. That's why I say, you know, Italy, you know, with the sense of gesture, with the way that they could communicate with their bodies, especially in the southern Italian cities, you know, which were known in particular for their almost extravagant gestural traditions. There was so much there. There was so much that could have made ballet really Italian. And it was Italian. It was there. And it was powerful and strong presence. It's just that it diminished. It diminished in the course of the 19th century.
And was that because of this displacement? Was it because of by opera? Was it because of a lack of sponsorship? Or
I think it was a lot of things. But I think in part it was because of politics. You know, the conflicts that Italy saw in the years of unification created enormous disruption in all kinds of traditions, but especially in ballet. And here we sort of come to one of the real challenges that dance of all kinds faces, but ballet in particular, which is notation. You know, it is not a tradition where there is an accepted and standardized way of writing things down. And so that when you have the kinds of disruption, opera houses closed, dancers set off and, you know, on the road and sent somewhere else, you don't have the kind of flexibility or malleability to or record, just the record to be able to keep things going as easily as you do in, say, with, say, music.
It would be good to, excuse the pun, underscore this here by giving the simple examples that we will never know exactly how Mozart played or sounded, though we have pretty detailed descriptions of it and we have many paintings and pictures. But any pianist today or any keyboard player can take a copy of Mozart's, not even something that was later printed, just what he wrote out, stick it on top of the piano, and if he or she knows how to play, they can play that music. They don't need any other information. And that's already going on then in the 18th century. In ballet, still, we have questions about notation, but certainly in these formative centuries, we don't have a system. We have alphabets for speech, and we have etiquettes for photography later and for painting, and we have notation for music, but not for dance.
Yes, that's right. There's only one short period where you have a notation that is still understood today. That was developed actually in the court of Louis XIV, the feuillet notation that dancers can read now. So we have a sort of short window, you know, there, but it's not long.
And you talk in the book about trying to work this out yourself, about trying to actually work through these steps.
That's right. Some of the steps, you know, because what you find with the notation, that particular notation, the feuillet notation in the late 17th and early 18th centuries, is that you see the notation, and then as the years pass, people start writing in the margins. They start drawing stick figures or writing out things. And what's happening is that the dance is outgrowing the notation. It's changing in ways that this particular notation cannot express. And so then eventually people stop using it.
Mm-hmm.
And But nothing really replaces it. And so you don't have it's not that ballet masters weren't trying. People were trying across the history of ballet, very concerned, very aware that without a text, it would be hard, first of all, to establish ballet as a major art form, and second of all, that, you know, that they were not able to send their dances to other dancers or places, and that there was no script.
Everything had to be handed by teacher, and not just in one session, but over years of training.
That's right, physically, you know, person to person. You know, really the history of dance is a chain of human beings. It's not a chain of texts. It's a chain of human beings.
So when there is no notation and the human chains get disrupted, as happens in the Risorgimento and the reunification of Italy or the unification of Italy, then these things get lost.
That's right. They can get lost. And you also have a situation where it's harder and harder for, the education of a dancer, the way in which a dancer can, as you said, you know, a musician can go back to Mozart and find things there. Mm-hmm. Dancer can't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, the main choreographer of the late 19th century in Italy was a man called Manzotti, and he was not a very educated or cultivated man, and he was really the dances that he put together, and we do have some film footage that gives us a good sense of what they were like, even though it's a little bit later than. You know, it's already handed down one generation. These were almost like giant parades. I mean, you had hundreds of people on stage, animals, and, lots of sets and scenery and special effects. And they were sort of grandiose spectacles. But the dancing in them was not of the highest artistic caliber.
The other country we mentioned was up north, and that's Denmark, and a gentleman with a French name, although also a complicated background, none of it Danish, though.
That's right.
Let's talk about Auguste Bourneville, and he continues to be an important figure to this day.
That's right. His ballets are still performed actually around the world. La Sylphide, which we talked about a little bit earlier, the version that we know is his version. He made his career in Denmark, supported by the Danish crown, but he always looked to France. His training was from France. His father was a dancer who had traveled all over Europe but settled in Denmark. But he too was French trained, and so Bourneville was constantly, you know, going to the French capital and then returning to Denmark, and. What he ended up doing there was basically taking the French tradition that he had learned in Paris and from his father and transplanting it to Danish soil and giving it a kind of Danishness. Mm-hmm. And this is something that really I find very, very sort of interesting is how the traditions absorb a kind of national identity and become something else.
So what would be an example of Danishness here?
Bourneville did several things. He was very interested in scale. So whereas many dancers in the 19th century were moving towards a larger and larger scale, the Russians, the Italians, even in some of the German states, they were moving towards large-scale productions. He was very interested in the details of technique. It was a much more sort of homespun, if you will, almost, with the kind of Lutheran ethic in a way that related to the Danish people. So you can see this in his technique, which has a big emphasis on small steps. So the small, clear, clean, honest steps of the Bourneville tradition are still to this day a great challenge for dancers because of their precision and their forthrightness, their plainness in a way.
So in some ways, what Bourneville does, and we should mention, too, he's one of the many people born in a trunk. His father had married at some point, but then when his wife died, the mother of his other children, he takes up with a Swedish housekeeper.
That's right.
And
Swedish
she's the mother of Monsieur Bourneville in Denmark. But what he's sort of done is he takes from France, and then he's got this very flat, clean, Lutheranish laboratory, and none of the intrigues and none of the politics of the mother country here. And so he's able then to develop
He's
all
really
these
in
things.
Control.
And he has
his,
it for 50 years, 47
that's
years
right,
or something?
A very long period. Yeah. And he works for a very long time, and he has dancers to work with. So, you know, and good conditions to work under. So he was really able to sort of craft a style that suited the country and the place that he had made his home.
We'll come to this subject more, too, as we move eastward. But I'm curious, even at this point, to what extent do different body types and so on play a role? Because obviously, we're not going to get into total awful 19th century racial theorizing or anything, but people are taller and shorter and thicker and thinner and wider and more narrow and have different leg lengths in all of these countries generally.
Yeah, no, that's right. Well, you know, ballet itself had sort of ideas about body type written into its practices because, you know, even in the 18th century, people thought that there was really a sort of noble way of moving that corresponded to an aristocratic level. And those bodies were long and lean and elegant and moved with a kind of gravitas. Then there was a sort of slightly shorter, stockier type that would be doing slightly faster kinds of movement and might play more sort of village roles or a less elevated part. And then there's the comic, right, mm-hmm. which is really the sort of shorter, faster, acrobatic physique that so this was
Harlequin
all into
or the, Puck or
exactly, you know. Exactly. And so this was all, you know, it very much accepted within the tradition. As far as body types, you know, nationally, I think that actually mattered less to people at the time. They were more, you know, interested in the social identification that bodies might have. So the more noble body type, you know, reaching back to sort of an ideal Greek, like the Apollo of ballet.
Social identification, political context, and lots of cultural and national and human history are all gateways, shall we say, and guideposts for Jennifer Homans in Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet, just out from Random House, a beautiful hardcover book with lots of very fine photographs as well. We are going to have to go now to a second part because we've only gotten up to the mid-19th century. And so we are going to ask you to listen again next week when Jennifer Homans, well, she won't still be in the studio, but she'll still be our guest through the miracle of recording. Jennifer Homans, thanks so much for not the first half because we can't replicate every page of the book, but for the first part of our discussion today.
Thank you, Andrew.
We'd like to thank Random House for bringing Jennifer back to Chicago and the Newberry Library and Seminary Co-op bookstores for sharing her with us, and Bill Young for bringing her to us at the studio. I'd like to thank Matt DeStefano, our producing engineer, for making this program sound great. We'd like to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Richard and Susan Kiphart, and other friends of this program. As we've said, you can hear this or any of our programs at wfmt.com/criticalthinking, where you can experience the free Critical Thinking podcast. And let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P, at AOL.com. We opened the program with perhaps the most respected modern recording of the complete music of Swan Lake, of Tchaikovsky, that by Charles Dutoit, recorded back in 1991 in Saint-Eustache, Montreal, by Dutoit and the Orchestre Symphonique de Montréal, the Montreal Symphony Orchestra, on the London Decca label. We opened with the Dance of the Young Swans from Act 4, and Let's Go Out with All That Drama at the Lake at the end, in the scène finale, the final scene of Act 4 of Swan Lake. We'll be talking about Swan Lake and Tchaikovsky in next week's program, Part 2 of our conversation with Jennifer Homans on her book, Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll dance your way and see you next week.